and nothing else.
عشتي تيما كبرتي تيما حياتي في الدنيا هذه ما عندها حتى قيمة. كبرت بلا عيلة وانا عندي خوتي بزاف، خوتي 22 واحد منهم ما عليا خاف. البراني دخل البيتي عادي عاد يضربني، يضربني في داري وحابي يخرجني من ارضي، ينتهك لي في عرضي يحقرني ويسبني. خوتي قاعدين يشوفوا هو كل يوم يغتصبني. خويا الكبير سكت ما بقاش يقدر على الكلام، واللي اقل منه هدر حكموا عليه بالاعدام. اختي الكبير
Well, we're listening to Palestinian-based music, I believe. That was beautiful music. And I'm Paul DiRienzo, and this is Trump Watch. And we're getting our guest on the line as we speak. That's Noura Erekat, who is a Palestinian-American legal scholar, human rights attorney, and assistant professor at the New Century College at George Mason University. And she's going to be speaking about the about Palestinian statehood and what effect that has had on the Palestinian struggle. And what we're going to try and explain the real root cause of Israel's actions against the Palestinians. Of course, this is a key issue at this time because the United States has decided to unilaterally move the its embassy to Jerusalem and to claim Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, although many, many agreements that we'll be hearing more about have argued against that move, and it's in violation of international law. And very few other countries have joined the United States in this move. It seems to be basically one of President Donald J. Trump's attempts to fulfill promises to his base, in this case his evangelical base, the evangelical Christians, the right-wing evangelical Christians out there. Many have argued that there needs to be a recognition of the state of Israel in order to fulfill biblical prophecy. And while that might seem ridiculous to some, to others, it is deadly serious. And to give you some idea, as we wait to get her on the line, President Donald J. Trump abruptly canceled his summit with North Korea. North Korea's Kim Jong-un today, blaming tremendous anger and open hostility by Pyongyang and abandoning for now a meeting that held the promise of a historic peace deal, but also the risk of diplomatic meltdown. In a letter to Kim announcing his decision to back away from the June 12th summit, Trump pointed to America's vast military might and warned the rising nuclear power, that being North Korea — this is an AP story, so of course it has a bias built into it — against any, quote, foolish or reckless acts. The letter kicked off a day of mixed messages by the president, who declared hours later that, "I really believe Kim Jong-un wants to do what's right." Then after that, a senior White House official said the North lacked judgment and had reneged on his promises ahead of the summit. I don't know if it's reneged on his promises, because yesterday they took reporters to the site of their nuclear testing facility, and it was pretty much observed, at least by non-professionals, reporters, to be blown up, the tunnels where the bombs were placed to be tested. So it seemed like, at least on the surface, which is more than anything we've seen in the recent past, Kim Jong-un was in fact following in his promises. I mean, the promises as they were laid out. So I'm not sure what promise President Trump says he hasn't finalized. But this is what interesting to me, is that they brought John Bolton in now as a national security advisor to the president, a man who has the president's ear, who is absolutely determined to pursue regime change in places like Iran and North Korea. Regime change means overthrowing and killing in the way they did in Libya to Muammar Gaddafi. And in fact, the Libya option was mentioned. So are these peace talks actually preliminary to war rather than peace? We know we'll be following that here on Trump Watch. So that said, is our guest on the line?
Yes.
Our guest is on the line. Great. Glad to have you. Noura Erekat, as I said earlier, you're a Palestinian-American, a legal scholar, human rights attorney, and an assistant professor at George Mason University. Welcome to Trump Watch.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Let me begin by basically asking what the question I raised a moment ago, what is it that explains Israel's actions against the Palestinians? And these actions are detailed in videos and writings that I had the opportunity to take a look at before we came here today, by bringing settlers in, forcing people from their land, imprisoning them in basically the jail of Gaza, splitting up the territories that they do have on the West Bank, and doing things that don't seem to be heading in the direction of finding a peaceful resolution to this long-standing conflict, but in fact pursuing a colonial agenda. What is the Israel's action? What explains Israel's actions against the Palestinians?
So you're asking a two-part question. The first part is meta, and asking about what explains Israel's relationship to all Palestinians, regardless of where they may be. And I guess the other question that's embedded in that, what explains Israel's action towards Palestinians last weekend in the Gaza Strip? And those are two different questions, but they're good in the sense that, let me start with the bigger picture, which is Israel has a settler colonial relationship to Palestinians. Israel has a settler colonial relationship to Palestinians. It, in 1917, because we should take it back that far, colonial Britain designated Palestine as the site of Jewish settlement and to make it into a Jewish national home. The problem with that designation is that 90% of the population at the time, 90%, are Arab Palestinians who are also being promised the right to be self-determined, to govern themselves in the aftermath of the First World War, as peoples all over the world are demanding that they have the right to be self-determined and are basically starting a global movement to delegitimize colonialism as a form of legitimate governance. That begins the history that we are now continuing to endure. As a result of this promise and as a result of suspending the Palestinian right to self-determination and British tutelage, Britain steadily increases and facilitates the increase in of the Jewish population in Palestine, so that by 1947, 30% of the population of Palestine has become Jewish, and now it's 70% Arab Palestinian. At this point, when the UN decides to partition the Palestine into two states, a Jewish state and an Arab state, notably where neither one would be exclusively Jewish or Arab, but would actually be heterogeneous, at this time, Palestinians reject partition and say that it's an injustice to partition the land when they are the majority, the land belongs to them, they are natives, Jews can stay, but they have to stay as immigrants within Palestine rather than as settler sovereigns. This and a series of other events basically leads up to the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, where Israel categorically wins. But it categorically wins and establishes armistice lines, never declares its borders, and has an intention to establish its sovereignty over all of the land. And despite the history of Palestine, negates that Palestinians are people with the right to self-determination, and regards them as Arab refugees who can go anywhere in the rest of the Arab world and be absorbed. No, that these are ongoing tropes and Israeli talking points that we continue to hear. And so this is, you know, what everything that we're hearing is quite old. The 1967 war, Israel comes to occupy the Sinai Peninsula, the Golan Heights, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. Between 1967 and 1987, Palestinians wage what is regarded as the revolutionary moment led by the Palestinian Liberation Organization to liberate all of Palestine and to establish a one-state solution. In 1988, Palestinians declare independence just in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, accept and recognize Israel as a country, as an entity, a political fact on the ground, and are basically telling Israel, we are happy to establish our sovereignty in 22% of the Palestine mandate in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Israel continuing its denial of Palestinian peoplehood, its desire for settler expansion, its desire to establish its sovereignty in all of what is regarded as of the Palestine mandate, basically torpedoes the two-state solution between 1993 and the present. And it has torpedoed that solution by building a wall that 85% of which runs through the West Bank, confiscating 13% of it, by annexing Jerusalem and declaring that it has sovereignty over it, obviating the potential for Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, to be the capital of a Palestinian state, by increasing its settler population from 200,000 in 1993 to 600,000 today, by establishing military law that forbids the presence of Palestinians in the West Bank to be in Gaza and Palestinians from Gaza to be in the West Bank, by increasing and enhancing the removal of Palestinians through retroactive taxes, through disproportionate services, through disproportionate home demolitions, through collective punishment, and obviously also by declaring large vasts of the West Bank, including 30% of it in the Jordan Valley, as military zones where Palestinians cannot travel.
Right.
What you have in the present day is the outcome of the settler colonial ambition, where Palestinians cannot exercise their sovereignty. The two-state solution is dead. When Trump announces that he is then going to recognize East Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, he is consecrating 7 decades of this settler colonial expansion and, frankly, 5 decades of U.S. foreign policy making on the issue. Although every other president has condemned Israel's settler settlement expansion policies, also facilitated it through unequivocal military, financial, and diplomatic aid. So Trump is not so much ruptured. This is not something he does that, like, he destroys the peace process. The peace process was dead. The two-state solution had been obviated. What Trump does is he creates a very coherent policy and ends the fiction that there is a peace process. But in so doing, is also going against the grain of the doublespeak that the U.S. had engaged in.
Mm-hmm. What is for folks on the Palestinian side who say who said to me, "Well, you want to fight Palestine? Go to Jordan. Jordan is Palestine. Why don't people just go there?"
What is that supposed to mean?
Yeah, I don't know. I've heard it said, and I'm just curious.
Hear it, and I feel like this is just another talking point, and it's what I mentioned earlier about how there is a denial that Palestinians are a juridical people. What does it mean to be a juridical people? It is the concept that a community shares a language, a history, a culture, and a political future and defines itself as a political community. It's not the people is different from population. And so it's the denial that this is a political community, that it is a nation that wants to govern itself within a state form. And when you say Palestinians can go to Jordan, you're basically saying that they're just like every other Arab population and they can go elsewhere. But Palestinians, one, are a nation that are attached to one another. And that's why Palestinians who are in the global diaspora, as well as those who are citizens of Israel and in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, all consider themselves a singular nation. Number two, by saying that they could go to Jordan, you are negating the fact that they have an attachment to this land. They have generations upon generations that have lived on this land and have no desire to leave. They're less concerned about having a Palestinian state than they are concerned about being able to stay in their homes and continue those legacies. And this is part of this disavowal of native attachment and what it means for native populations to continue to exist and why we shouldn't flippantly, you know, regard migration. You know, people migrate all the time. This is not the same thing. Israel is asking them to leave, to never come back, and to renounce any attachment they had to their homes, to their orange orchards, to the places where their family is married, to the relationship to water sources, to the religious significance that they had to the land. And you have to question, you know, It's a really dehumanizing framework to basically say, well, just leave. But they don't want to leave. They want to stay. And in fact, when Trump announces that Jerusalem is, you know, the unified capital of, or recognizes Jerusalem as Israel's capital, the other thing that's going on there is that Palestinians don't care that they don't have a capital in East Jerusalem anymore. Palestinians understand this declaration as the green light for Israel to enhance and accelerate its ethnic cleansing process. And ethnic cleansing, I don't say that lightly here.
Yeah.
Ethnic cleansing is what we understand, but in international law, it's known as a forced population transfer. It is prohibited as a war crime. It is prohibited as part of the Apartheid Convention of 1973. You are not to forcibly transfer populations, and yet that is exactly what Israel is doing in Jerusalem and throughout the rest of the Mandatory Palestine. And when Trump makes this announcement, the fear for Palestinians is that Israel will now accelerate that process of removal, now under the framework of sovereignty, because Trump has recognized that this is part of Israel's sovereign jurisdiction, when in fact, under international law, it's not. This would be considered territory annexed through conquest, which ceased to be recognized as a legitimate form of territorial capture since the late 19th century. So the response I have to people is, why we have to recognize that Palestinians are making a political claim as native people. It's the same reason that the Navajo Nation wants to live in Arizona and not where the Mohawk lives on the border of Canada and New York. This is not about where people, you know, can move about. The worst part about it, though, in Palestine, what makes it more difficult, is that they don't even have the freedom of movement.
Right.
Right?
So, I want to focus a little bit on Gaza for a moment, and in particular, a term that the Israelis seem to use, Israeli military and the present government seem to use with abandon, considering the effect of it, mowing the lawn. What do they mean when they say they're mowing the lawn in Gaza?
It's actually a very perverse. It's part of a military lexicon. It's very perverse, and our antennas should go up. That this is going to mean devastation for civilian populations. Basically, in a counterterrorism framework, the idea is that non-conventional insurgents, right, who are not part of a conventional army, can develop their military capacity and their personnel capacity to wage irregular combat, right? When you say you want to mow the lawn, when the U.S. administration says that in regards to Pakistan, Afghanistan, or other sites, or when Israel says it wants to do that to Palestinians, it basically says that it wants to diminish the capacity of those irregular forces, to diminish their military capacity, and to diminish their personnel capacity to actually wage any kind of resistance or any kind of belligerent threat. What it means in practice, so that's nice,
yeah,
right?
Right?
As a military concept, you're like, oh, yeah, but that's what they should do. How else are you going to diminish their military advantage? But in practice, what mowing the lawn looks like is what we saw in 2014 in the Gaza Strip. It's what we saw in 2008 and 2009. It's what we saw in 2012 when Israel basically bombards a besieged coastal enclave of 365 square miles. Without regard to distinguishing between civilians and military targets. And Israel constantly says, oh, no, but we can't distinguish civilians because Hamas uses civilians as human shields. You have to question that. Number one, this is a densely populated area. It's one of the most dense populated areas in the world. Almost anywhere, and of the 2 million people living there, 15,000 are Hamas members. That means anywhere you go, right, you're likely going to be targeting civilians and not Hamas. Number two, Israel never investigated itself or allowed an international investigation to actually determine whether or not it was following a protocol on distinction and proportionality. In one case, the UN gave Israel the GPS coordinates of an UNRWA compound that was used to shelter civilians, where there were no weapons and there were no combatants.
That's United Nations Refugee
Works Agency.
Yeah.
And it was used as a shelter for civilians. And the UN gave Israel its coordinates 17 times. And Israel struck the school anyway and insist that there was a Hamas militant who passed by the school on a motorbike. And as he was passing, they were trying to target him. And they just happened to shell a school with 3,000 civilians who were taking shelter. story upon story of this repeated narrative. By the end of 51 days of bombardment in the summer of 2014, Israel had killed over 2,200 Palestinians, about 354 of whom were children. In the course of that war, it never was held to account, and in fact insists that it can change the laws of war, making all of its actions during that time not only permissible for itself, but as a proposition to change the laws of war in other fields of non-conventional combat, so that you can, you know, as Israel army ethicists have suggested, we no longer compare the number of Israeli civilians killed to the number of Palestinian civilians killed. It doesn't matter anymore. Now we have a different way of looking at it. It's basically about how to ensure Israel's military dominance and military edge,
right,
which really inverts humanitarian law on its head because it means that civilians are going to be the prey.
That's very interesting, because I can see that too in what you're describing. In the old days, they used to talk about, well, you know, some people were killed. Now we're going to kill this many people in retaliation. That's all fallen long ago by the wayside. Now it's all the stories have been pulled, you know, all the explanations and the justifications have been pulled aside, and it's just might makes right. It seems to me.
On the face of it, absolutely. But I think if we dig a little deeper, it's actually more scary than that, because if it was just might makes right, the world would be upset and indignant. This is about the powerful domineering the weak, which is really the response we should have. But as a matter of law, Israel isn't just insisting that might makes right. It's literally changing the rules of warfare in order to accommodate its colonial dominance. So that, for example, the way that it's justifying the killing of 62 Palestinians in Gaza, it submitted a brief to the Supreme Court in response to Israeli human rights organizations who basically thought that the military went too far when they killed 14 Palestinians on March 30th when these protests started. The Israeli argument, the Israeli government and army's argument, is that it was using preventive self-defense, even though these Palestinians did not pose a threat, that at some point, had they been able to breach the border, the non-existent border, the settler frontier, had they been ordered to breach the electrified fence that Israel created and gotten into Israeli territory, they would have somehow been able to run the miles that it takes to run on foot to the nearest Israeli city, Ashdod, and when they got there, they would have posed some sort of lethal threat. That's a very tenuous argument to be able to make. They couldn't even get barely past the buffer zone. And then they would be unarmed running to the nearest Israeli city, where surely Israeli police could have thwarted them from coming. And so the idea that Israel had 6 weeks between March 30th and the events that happened last Monday to think about how to ensure its security and its self-defense, if that's indeed what it was interested in. Instead, last week, its Israeli army snipers sat on a hilltop 300 meters away and shot deliberately at Palestinians, shot to kill them where they were on their own land.
Right.
Because
we're coming to the end of last minute, we're talking to Noura Erekat, who's a Palestinian-American legal scholar. So I just want to wrap up by saying now we're talking about Donald Trump's policies as well, his style as well, to rip apart the norms. And in that way, they seem to be coming together, the Israeli government's policies and the American policies under this president.
I think, you know, something that we should think about and what would be really enlightening for U.S. audiences especially is that there's been a mythology of Israel being the beacon of democracy in the Middle East. But what Israel has set up in the Middle East is what we're seeing more and more of now in the United States, which is basically a garrison state of righteous racial and religious supremacy, whereby you can use military force to break apart families, to create electrified fences between people, where you can subjugate a tier of people based on this righteous conception of racial and religious supremacy. Israel has been on that path, has always been on that path. And so the fact that, we propagate, but it's the only democracy in the Middle East, it's only the only democracy if we think that Palestinians do not exist. because if we include Palestinians in that framework, we can see that it actually functions like an apartheid regime, and one that the U.S. has supported, just like it supported apartheid South Africa and Southwest Africa, now known as Namibia.
Right.
And Donald Trump now pursues similar regime here in the United States, where we're arresting people for speaking Spanish and where we're breaking families apart and picking up children at school to deport them. That is a path that Israel has paved in a future that it promises, and why alternative futures that can be forged by advocating for Palestinian freedom are within hand and should be supported.
Thank you very much, Noura Erekat, for joining us on Trump Watch. We'll have you on again to talk more about this. Thank you. والسودة صاروا كلاب الزمان يلبسوها كموضة مهما تفننوا فيها مهما غيروا بلونة كفية عربية بتضل عربية حطتنا بدنا إياها